present, we have Senators Elton, Wickham, Olson, and myself, Dyson. And we're going to take the bill previously heard first, SB 84, Child Protection Confidentiality, then SB 51, the Public Assistance Programs, and then two new bills, SB 75, Public Health Disasters and Emergencies, and SB 75, State Virology Labs Laboratory. And we may not get through them all. That's our intention. If there's anyone here who has real time constraints and needs to speak kind of out of order, let me know, let Jason know, and we'll try to accommodate you and appreciate your patience. Alright, we're going to take up Senate Bill 84, Confidentiality. Jan?
Senator Dyson and members of the committee, my name's Jan Rutherdale. I was here 2 days ago when this came up, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. And I've made, in response to the comments at the last hearing, I've prepared some amendments, and hopefully you have them in front of you. I've met with Jason and...
Yeah, and that should be this document, two pages, three word changes on the first page, and three different changes on a second page. And Jan, I'd like to take the two pages separately. I think the first one should be uncontroversial, and there'll be more discussion on the second page
as I read it. A good order to do it in.
All right.
The first one, which is to amend page 6, line 26, after department, to add the governor or the legislature. That was done to address Senator Elton's concern that what if the governor wanted to convene some sort of legislative or investigative body to review a specific case, or what if the legislature wanted to convene some sort of committee or something to review a specific case. So those changes were made.
Any questions about that? And for the record, we've been joined by Senator Green about 137. Any objections or questions on that first amendment? Seeing none.
Okay. And then on page 8, line 9, this again was in response to a concern of Senator Elton's why originally it was shall, and now and then when we revised it, it was may. And I don't think it matters either way, so we put it back to shall. But perhaps a just by way of explanation, this is a little wider. This covers all the regulations, including that specific concern about the sufficient legitimate interest paragraph that had been moved from another section. And so it may not be necessary in some cases, but in any case, apparently there's case law that requires whenever there's a term or standard that's used for the public, we're required to have regulations. And so, you know, that's why it's the case law kind of puts that shell in there, so it didn't matter either way.
But Jan, just what's a reasonable expectation for the time frame in which regulations we get promulgated after we pass a law? And has that been challenged in court? Has somebody come and said, wait a minute, department was supposed to do X and Y and it didn't, and it leaves them with a key course of action?
Right. You know, I cannot answer that whatsoever. There's sort of two parts to your question. One is, what would be a reasonable expectation for this particular bill? I mean, you know, when could we expect some regulations? And maybe I think Marcy Kanai might be participating by telephone. Maybe she can address that. And then the second is, if it wasn't timely, like, what would be the mechanism for enforcement? and I don't know that either. I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
I wanted to amend a statement I made last time, which was that I didn't believe there was any regulations that have been promulgated. There are regulations that apply to confidentiality, but those are very old. I think they were promulgated in 1980 or something. And so, I didn't want to leave the impression there's no regulations. There are. It's just that it's been a very long time period
since they've been looked at.
Right. And I think my understanding is that it's the Office of Children's Services intends to modify or promulgate regulations, but as for their timing, I don't know.
Marcia, are you online? Is there anybody here from the department? Okay.
Did anybody have any questions about that? Or?
I think we're fine.
Okay. And then the next one, page 8, lines 15 to 16, that's not something that was requested of this body, but someone in my department, this was the original wording under, and then during a tech edit, it was in accordance with, was replaced, and it was felt that under was a better word. I don't see what the difference is, but I don't think it hurts it to have under, and the person that has more expertise in the tort liability said that it would be important to have under.
All right. Any questions on that one? All right, I'm going to mark this first page here as amendment number 1, and the chair will entertain a motion on amendment 1.
Move to adopt amendment number 1.
Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment 1 is adopted. Next page we'll call amendment 2. This is the page that the issue brought up by Mr. Calder and Senator Wilkin, dealing with the issue of why parents aren't in the list of folks who can get confidential information.
Right.
And this is your response to that concern, right?
It is. And I hope that I can articulate better why it belongs where it does, and why it doesn't belong in subsection B. So it just, as you mentioned, concern was raised at the last hearing that parents aren't on this list under subsection B of the people that the agency shall disclose appropriate confidential information to, and the answer I gave is that the parents are parties to a case and they get the all this information and more. I mean, it's not a discretionary. They get the file with certain exceptions that the court lays out in the court order, and I can go into those in a minute. But I wanted to start just by reading you the definition of parties, because it's defined by Child Need of Aid Rule 2L. And it says, party means the child, the parents, the guardian. You won't always have a guardian, but sometimes you have both parents and guardians caring for the child. The guardian ad litem, and the department. And those people would be the parties to the case in all cases. I suppose there's cases where a guardian ad litem wouldn't be appointed, but for the most part they are in all of them. And then an Indian custodian who has intervened. An Indian custodian is a term out of the Indian Child Welfare Act, and I don't really need to go into it, but it would be like a grandparent who has assumed a parental role in raising the kids. They're not legally guardian, but they are the custodian. They're the caretaker. It's not an automatic intervention. They actually have to move to intervene before they get party status. And then the Indian Child's Tribe, if there is an Indian Child's Tribe who has intervened, it's not automatic. They have to actually move to intervene. And then any other person who has been allowed to intervene in the court. That's the definition of party. So parents are, no question, they are a party to the case. And as parties to the case, like in all civil cases, they are entitled to discovery. And there's court rules, in specifically in the child need of aid case, but it kind of, it generally refers back to the civil process with a few exceptions. And so what I've proposed is so that it can be hopefully assured to everyone that that we haven't forgot about parents in terms of getting access to the file, to add and to subsection A, which is the blanket general prohibition of dissemination of the file, except as listed in subsection B and with some other subsections, and as provided to all parties in a child in need of aid proceeding in accordance with court rules. And I have an example. Each district, I don't claim that this is the way all courts do it, but there's, as I was saying the other day, there's whenever this is a document that's for the appointment of counsel when they request an attorney and one's appointed, in addition to the appointment boxes that are checked, there's just a boilerplate that says, it's further ordered that counsel is authorized access to relevant non-privileged information from the Department of Health and Social Services records, except as follows, and it has a few standard exceptions if it would violate the right of privacy of a person not a party to this action. For example, everything gets into these files, so if you're talking about the little boy next door who, you know, there's some confidential information that has nothing to do with the case, that would be an exception because they're not a party to the action. Material that reveals the reporters' names, because we have the reporting statutes that says they're confidential, as long as they're not using the person as a witness. If that person's being called, obviously we have to release that person's name and their statements. The material which, if released, would endanger the safety of a minor. For example, and I would say this is a good example that may come up frequently. If you have a parent who's naturally very upset that their child is in another home and they're threatening to remove that child out of the home or threatening to hurt that child or hurt the foster parents, it would, you know, if you release the address of those foster parents, it would endanger the safety of a minor. And then it goes on to say parties and attorneys are ordered to maintain the confidentiality of the information provided and not disclose it to non-parties without authorization of the court. And that way you don't have it just broadcast all over town. And then attorneys, they cannot provide copies to anyone, but they can share the information, of course, with their own clients, the parents, and with expert witnesses in preparation for trial. And so that's an example of a standard order, at least that's how it is for all cases that come before the court, the discovery order and their access to the file in Juneau. And it may be a little bit different in other regions, but I think the point is this is something that's not, I don't believe it's appropriate to be placed in a statute. This is the sort of the promise of the court to have these orders determining what the discovery is. And I wanted to say that I spoke with the district attorney's office this morning just to see if the criminal discovery process is the same, and it's identical. In the sense of there's a when an attorney enters their entry of appearance or appointment of counsel is made, they file a discovery motion. The DA's office supplies them with the discovery, the police reports, that sort of thing. If there's any, they don't. I think there's, he said there was an actual court rule that said you may not give copies to the clients, but they can share it, of course, to read the police reports. So I think I think this is a good solution to the issue that was raised. And then the other amendment was to remove subsection B1, a guardian ad litem appointed by the court. It doesn't necessarily have to be done, but a guardian is a party, and it seems sort of odd that they're the only party that is actually listed in here, and so just to clean that up.
Let's see if I got it.
Okay.
Subsection A really talks about the people who are always considered a party to the case unless they're excluded or non-existent. And subsection B, with your amendment here, is all the groups who and individuals who are not a party that might be included in the confidential information.
Right. It's exactly. Subsection A is the general rule that they're confidential with certain exceptions, and so I propose to include the parties. Right. And then B is correct. All the people listed on there are not parties to a case.
Right.
And they're... It's kind of a limited access to information. It's sort of as needed basis.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman, move amendment number 2.
Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment 2 is adopted. I might note the committee's interest that this bill does have a judiciary referral, and those of you who retain some concerns about this might want to raise that with the Judiciary Committee. What else do we have on this bill? That's it? Are there any other questions on this bill? All right, I have Betty Rollins online in Fairbanks. Betty, can you hear us?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. I take great exception to the previous statement by the Attorney General. We are not talking just about court action where people are parties to a case. We're talking about day-to-day operation. And I did send a fax down to you this morning, Senator Dyson, explaining some of my concerns. But in this particular case, why is the state fighting so hard to keep the parents out of the loop? You must understand that most of these people that have their children in care are represented by a public defender. And I was told at a meeting, Judge Steinkruger said that some of these public defenders have up to 100 cases during a year. This doesn't give them time to respond to each parent. The parent must be privileged to any information that the foster parent, the guardian ad litem, anyone in this case, they must be privileged to get that information without their attorney. Because many times I've seen cases where the parent will continually call their attorney and they don't see them until the date of the hearing. They do not get the information. The parent must be put back in there. And as I say, I did send a fax down this morning. I sent an email and messed that all up, so don't pay attention to the email. But the fax with a lot of my concerns, the federal law, I read over that again, and I don't think it really states that that people are not allowed to get public information. I'm not a lawyer, and I do wish that someone, maybe the Attorney General's office, would explain some things on that. Why the federal law prohibits and what it prohibits. But anyhow, my major concern is keeping the parent in the loop. I do not believe it is acceptable, the amendment that was just passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Betty? All right. Also in Fairbanks, we have Scott Calder. Scott, please give us your testimony. Try to keep it to 2 minutes if you can, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I was a little concerned earlier when you skipped over my name on the sign-up list, but I appreciate your courtesy now. My testimony was interrupted on Monday, and you told me to hang on. I was about to explain the implications of Chapter 117, SLA 1990, the Citizen Review Panel for Permanency Planning Act of 1990, an essential program that was never properly implemented and is currently the subject of other legislation, which I hope will pass. Mr. Chairman, there is mentioned that there are remedies available to parents out here in the real world. That is not as represented by the administrative employees who are before you. Without casting any aspersions there, I think we have different viewpoints which must be considered, including my own. And it is my considered opinion and experience that, that things are not really as represented by the state. They have an adversarial interest in the matters where, you know, we have authorized them to protect and serve people. However, the thing that is continually left unsaid, as Ms. Rollins just pointed out, is that the parents who are, you know, just basically trying to mind their own business and are molested get out of the loop because there's an absence of the presumption of innocence throughout our statutes. What we basically need for our system, Mr. Chairman, is a reality check and a smell test. Not an elaborate one, but just something that can be called that. We just received the amendments here at the LIO, and I haven't really had time to look at them. They just came in a minute ago, and I don't want to run out of time. I do agree with the may to shall. I think that's a good idea to avoid Senator Elton's concern. I'm sorry, is there an interruption? May I continue?
Yeah, that wasn't from this end. I don't know where that came from, Scott.
Okay, we didn't have that here either. Anyway, thank you. The subsection B thing, referring to 471093A, it is true that in section F, that it refers to people with legitimate interest, et cetera. However, the problem is that parents, as people with legitimate interests, are routinely abused or at least maybe just kind of shuffled around a little bit too harshly in these proceedings, which is what it is that we're concerned about. We do not already have all of the information and more, as was stated. And in fact, administrative records are kept secret in spite of the fact that not all, that the court records may be available directly or indirectly to the parties, such as parents. But there are records which are withheld, which are of a secret and confidential nature, which prejudice parents. I would like to see greater respect for ICWA representatives and tribal representatives. I'll leave that at that. And having personally attempted to gain discovery in an important matter of my own interest, I can tell you that it is not easy to discover information.
Could you summarize, Scott?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that might be real close here. Citizen review panel thing, the Citizen Foster Care Review Board that you referred to on Monday had existed under 4710-400 at Sequentia, was renumbered to 4714-200 at Sequentia. Then the sunset lapsed and the funding disappeared. But, Mr. Chairman, that program was never implemented according to law. And if it had been, we would not be in the situation that we're in today. And so I would really encourage the committee to hold this bill up maybe until next year until we see other needed reforms or consider working with me in greater length to maybe introduce some more balanced language. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Any questions for Scott? Scott.
Yes, sir.
Two issues here. We're trying to craft as good a law as we can, and you raised a very valid point that even if you do that well, it still can break down in how it gets executed and how it works out. And you're not the first one to say that the public defenders representing parents are often difficult to find and so on. That is a very valid point and should be raised in some venue. Here we're trying to get at crafting a good law. Now, this bill next goes to the Judiciary Committee, and that really is a good venue for raising those questions. Here, I suspect our primary issue is protecting the safety of the children and information not getting to people that shouldn't have it. And I'd really encourage you to weigh in again in a Judiciary hearing. But thank you for your
time.
Sure.
Sir, I appreciate everything that you just said. I would just like to point out, if I may, that you can't really ensure or encourage or promote the safety of children by forcing all parents to live in a critically dangerous world where the children's lives may be severely upset and permanently harmed. I don't see this as an either-or proposition, and I'm very interested in finding the middle ground, which I'm sure exists here. But there's sets of contrary interests at work here, and it really doesn't work to uphold one at the detriment of the other. Both must be upheld, in my opinion. And I believe that there's a way to do that, and I think that I can demonstrate that to people who will listen. And I will be back again and ask you to listen.
All right. Thank you.
Today again.
Thank you, sir. All right. Anything further on this, Jason? All right. The chair will entertain a motion on this bill. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I move SB84/A with as amended with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves. We will now take up SB 51, Public Assistance Programs. I believe this bill has picked up a fiscal note.
Social services.
Thank you, Jim. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ellie Fitzgerald, and I'm Chief of Policy and Program Development in the Division of Public Assistance. Director Farnham wasn't able to be here today, but we appreciate you continuing hearing Senate Bill 51. She asked me to respond to Senator Wilkins' question about the percentage of the caseload that came up on Monday with our partner, Cook Inlet Tribal Council. And we looked at the caseload, and when Cook Inlet Tribal and Bristol Bay Native Association and the Nelic Association come on board with their Native Family Assistance programs, we'll have approximately 35% of the temporary assistance families in Alaska being served by Native organizations. So I think that was one of the things that was left outstanding for me.
Any questions for Ellie? Ellie, there's grave concern in this legislature just about the expanding costs of the Medicaid, Medicare, and so on. Is it true, or is it your department's representation that this does not increase costs and that there's no vulnerability to increase costs as a result of, in essence, subcontracting this to these organizations?
Senator Dyson and members of the committee, as you know, the Temporary Assistance Program is a federal block grant program with a maintenance of effort provision that the state contribute funding to receive that block grant. And as that the authorization of the TANF block grant continues through Congress, the proposals to date show that there's level funding. Congress is about to undertake reauthorization now. The bill that was introduced in the House that's pretty much mirrors the President's proposal last year and what's being proposed in the Senate keeps levying funding level. So over time, I mean, our best guess right now is that level, you know, that funding will stay level. In Alaska, we've been fortunate enough with our caseload reduction to be able to, you know, invest our federal dollars into programs and services for families, and it is not costing us anymore. In fact, the fiscal note shows that about a $2 million general fund savings as a result in the adjustment of our maintenance of effort to as part of running these programs.
So I think the implication, I think, from the question raised by Senator Wilkin Monday or whatever it was that what happens if the federal funding goes away, and will we have accepted at least implied obligation to keep the funding at that level with state funds?
The way that the current statute is structured and our grants is that they are subject to appropriation. And these grants are negotiated year to year. So as if appropriations were to change, that is something we would need to renegotiate with each of the Native organizations based on the new appropriation each year. Did that answer your question?
You didn't say yes or no. Senator Wilkin.
Well, it's sort of a finance issue, and I'm sure we'll talk about it when it gets to finance, but
I would hope as this bill marches along that it's very clear in this bill that if a dollar of federal money goes away, the corresponding dollar goes away in the general fund, and the general fund of the future is not expected to pick up the shortfall in federal revenue. So people can adjust as they wish, and if a legislature that follows this legislature wants to change that, so be it. But I think that's very important, that we don't build these programs on federal funding, that we just have to look at the newspaper yesterday to see what may happen and will happen with pressure upon the federal budget. So
certainly, that's been our experience to date. In fact, cumulatively, it's been about $8 million per year in general fund that we've saved, with about $33 million since we started running Native programs in Alaska in 2000. So we've been able to sustain the funding. We've been able to, through our caseload reduction, continue to provide support and services to the families receiving services from the state program. And certainly it's something that has to be considered year to year. But I believe the statute, the way it prescribes the state to look at fair and equitable funding based on what it would otherwise cost the state to serve those families is one mechanism you have to ensure that. In addition, I'd just like to note that there is no requirement in the federal law that states provide supplemental funding. It's something that the Administration of Children and Families does consider as they approve the tribal programs plans, because they want to ensure that they financially will be able to operate the programs, but there is no federal requirement. However, if a Native organization was, you know, ever caught in a situation where they couldn't afford to run the program without or with reduced state funding, then they have the option to rescind from the program, and then it becomes the state's responsibility to provide assistance and services, and then, you know, it could increase our general fund maintenance of effort need, but that's something that we hope to avoid, certainly.
Senator, welcome to continue.
On that point, go ahead, but I have another question.
Well, okay. I've looked at some audits that were done on two or three programs in Health and Human Services, and these are operations that were happening right here in the greater Juneau area, and they pointed out some significant irregularities in the past in how the funding of I keep calling them subcontractors, but to another group that's not a strictly a state organization. There was one of them, there was an overpayment of 200 and some thousand dollars and never an attempt to recover. Another one, there was 586,000 that was misappropriated. What do you do to, when you in essence contract with an organization or even in-house, to audit the performance and that the money is being used? And with these we're talking about here, which is order of magnitude expanded, what will you do to audit the performance and track the money?
There, currently, and there is a provision in the statute, I think it's probably on page 5, that requires that they be audited at least by a certified public accountant. In our department, in our grants and contracts section, we also abide by the state requirement that they have a single audit every year by an independent contractor who also audits their program and their records and provide and reports back to the department on their findings. In addition, as we go through our program legislative audit each year, there is an audit to see that the funds were spent appropriately and bills were paid appropriately. The way that these grants are currently structured, the amount of money that we provide is for the assistance payment. So certainly we're looking at to see that they're paying eligible families. But they do have some authority to have, you know, some different rules in the state in the way they apply policies, not in the amount of money that they pay families. They can't pay any more than the state would pay, but how they apply policies. And I think several years ago when we were negotiating this current law, you heard some of the things from Tanana Chiefs about their substance abuse and screening programs, and Lincoln Haida had a special program to address domestic violence, and I'm sure each of the Native organizations can tell you how they've kind of customized the programs for that. So the audit really that the state completes is based on the amount of money being spent to eligible families, and that's all that's in place right now.
So let's say this bill makes it through here and this session gets done, May, signed into law. When would you expect that these programs would start getting cranked up? A couple, 3 months?
Tlingit and Haida, AVCP and Bethel, and Tanana Chiefs are all currently operating programs, so they would continue to operate. Kuku'unlut Tribal Council is, we're working with them very closely on an implementation plan to begin operation July 1, 2005. Bristol Bay Native Association and Manilik had hoped for October 2005. However, they've had some internal resource problems, illness of staff, and their planning efforts are being delayed. So it'll be probably 2006 before those programs, the two, Bristol Bay and Manilik, are able to start.
Certainly the documentation you've given us and the report and the testimony we've heard said that the existing organizations are doing very well and saving money and serving their clients well, and I really applaud that. Have the existing programs that are in place now been gone through their audit?
Senator Dice, members of the committee, yes, they have. They're audited every year by their independent auditors. And I also note that they also have obligations to report many of the similar demographic information and financial information to the federal Administration for Children and Families as part of receiving their federal money directly.
So what I'm going to ask you to do is get us a copy of both the audits that have been done and the reports that they turned in, and we'll attach that with the bill as it goes on through the process. And then that when the subsequent audits are done in the future, that you route that to the whoever is chair of the HES and Finance Committees at that point, please. All right, any other questions? Yes, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the caseload information, but I still don't understand, and we can just flag it and talk about it in finance, but I still don't understand the bill reauthorizes and puts in place permanently a pilot program, but the fiscal note only has to do with one component, that being CITC. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkins, members of the committee, that's correct. The financing associated with the other three organizations are in our operating budget. They've been in place since 2000, and so they're not coming as part of this new program.
Okay. We'll just talk about that more in finance. So thank you for that.
Senator Green.
To follow up on that, Kuku'unlut Tribal Council is the only new program.
Senator Green, members of the committee, Kuku'unlut Tribal is the new program. Although Bristol Bay Native Association and Manilik Association have also submitted letters of their intent to begin running, as I said, they hoped October 2005, but because of delayed planning, it'll probably be 2006. The numbers are significantly smaller for these two organizations.
I do not follow it. And I know I'd heard a discussion on the ability for the county fund handling through the Native groups to have different benchmarks and requirements and things for members for qualifying. Can they also pay out less than the state payment to that same person would be if it were going through a state office?
Senator Green, members of the committee, yes, they do have that option.
Would that mean then, if I can continue, Michelle, sure. Would that mean then if they could use that, quote, leftover money for new and different things versus having it for that particular program, or could they create something else?
Senator Green, members of the committee, yes, they can. Not with the state supplemental funding. That is funding we provide for making assistance payments. But they certainly can use their federal block grant monies, just like we can, to provide, to invest in services and provide supports to help low-income families become self-sufficient. They still are tied to the strings of TANF, as we are, in terms of how that money can be spent. It must meet the purpose of the program, but they do have some, they have flexibility, just like the state does, to decide what that is.
Your records would always reflect exactly what they paid out and what it went for versus what they qualified for. The records, the information given to you would always verify if that person has received less than they were allowed.
That's correct. Each month they submit to us a report of the benefits paid to families. And then they also submit a quarterly report of benefits paid to families. And this year we've been, our grants and contracts section is adjusting that reporting a little bit, but it is all about the benefits paid to families and not the other types of services that they've invested in.
Okay. Well, you had said that there was the ability to use, I guess, state funds in a different way. But you're confined on the TANF federal funds.
I think she said the converse.
Did you say the opposite? Okay. Is there any way you could enlarge or debit one account and give you more flexibility with the extra? Or is it very clearly spelled out how, which money is to go first? Or is there a match? Or
Senator Green, members of the committee, the Native organizations have, like I said, the same flexibility in the state in that you have your federal money and you have the state maintenance of effort, in the case of the Native organizations, the supplemental funds. What we have done through these pilot programs and what this proposal continues is that the amount that the state contributes is just to provide the supplemental funds needed to pay assistance. So the amount of the monthly check that goes to the family to meet their needs as opposed to the assistance that they might provide in the form of child care or hiring case managers or purchasing interview clothing, that kind of thing. And then the Native organization, the majority of them need more than their federal block grant, of course, to provide assistance to families, and so that's what they typically use the state funding first for. They do have that flexibility.
Maybe Ellie and I'll get a chance to visit outside the room, and I can get a better understanding. Thank you.
Yeah, I have one more question, and this, you might want to get Tony to weigh in here, but we have in this committee expressed a strong feeling that people who are unwilling to relocate where work is ought not to get their various kinds of welfare if they're unwilling to relocate or unwilling to work. And I believe that there's a regulation, or maybe it's federal, that says if the community has more than 50% unemployment, that the benefits can extend past the 60 months. Can you explain that to me and where that comes from?
Yes, Senator Dyson and members of the committee, there is a provision in federal law, and it's also in our current state law, not this bill, only this bill, but also in our governing statute for the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, that exempts from the 60-month time limit families who are living in Alaska Native Village or in on a reservation if the number of adults is 50%, number of adults not working is 50% or more. And so there are communities in Alaska, in other states it's in reservations, where in that poor economic situation they are not subject to the 60-month time limit.
So could we change the state statute so that the federal or the state component of the funding does not have to expend past the 60 months for people who are unwilling to relocate where work is?
Senator Dyson, members of the committee, I think that's probably something we would need to consult with our legal folks on. It is specific in the federal TANF law, and I wouldn't feel comfortable at this point answering yes or no. I think we would need to consult whether there's a constitutional issue or not.
Yeah, and Tony, maybe you guys would think about where the administration is on that issue, and you know, and what you all think is the wise thing to do. I will inquire, and if based on feedback from you guys and our legal people, and talking to some of my elder friends about that, and perhaps amend this bill if the title's broad enough to exclude state participation for people who are unwilling to relocate to where the job is, if the federal will allow us to do that. You want to weigh in on that one, Tony?
Senator, I'd be happy to take that as a research project and discuss that with the commissioner, and take the opportunity to get back to the committee on that if that's what you'd like.
Yeah, I believe this bill will pass out of committee here, but if you get back to me, and I would appreciate it. And this is Tony Lombardo, Deputy Commissioner. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions in the committee? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remind me what happened to the application of the original four people where Metlakatla wasn't financed?
Senator Olson and members of the committee, at the time the pilot legislation passed, Metlakatla had expressed an interest in participating. However, after they really looked at the operational side and the funding and the number of families served, they just decided not to do it.
One additional question, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the other nine that are coming on board, is there not a chance that they're going to be a part of that as well? And that should be figured into the financial concern that was expressed by Senator Wilkin.
Senator Olson and members of the committee, we have not heard interest from any of the others other than Bristol Bay Native Association and Nealik. Copper River had considered it, but again, because of the caseload size and their circumstances, they've chosen
Thank
not
you,
to.
Chairman.
I'd also just like to note that the majority of them are also contractors for us to provide work services, and are doing a pretty good job doing that, and are satisfied with that extent.
All right. Any other questions? I personally really appreciate what you report of what these groups have been done and the other ones' willingness to step up. I have three people who have asked to testify on this bill. My guess is the bill will pass out of committee today, but we want to give you a chance to testify if you want to, and we certainly want to hear from you. The first one I have is Don Schiersel in Fairbanks. Did I say that right, Don?
Yes.
Yeah, please give us your testimony, Don.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Don Schiersel. For the past 21 years, I've been Director of Family Services for the Division of the Family Services Division of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. I hold a master's degree in behavioral disabilities and vocational rehabilitation from the University of Wisconsin, and administer approximately $12 million of the total $80 million TCC annual budget of state and federal health and social service programs. As a social service professional and program planner who's been actively engaged in state and national tribal welfare reform policy discussions for the past 12 years, I strongly support the spirit and intent of SB 51. In a state of our immense size with its unique economic, geographic, and demographic environments, it makes a lot of sense to locally design and administer services such as those provided under the Temporary Assistance Program. SB 51, for the most part, is consistent with the same devolution rationale from which state and federal welfare reform emerged. Programs closest to the people are more responsive, relevant, effective, and efficient than the large, centrally operated, one-size-fits-all programs planned and administered from far away from the communities and families that they are intended to serve. TCC's tribally administered temporary assistance program is currently in its seventh year of operation. While like all programs, there will always be room for improvement, the tribes of the interior are proud of the accomplishments they have collectively made to date in getting people from welfare to work. The report to the Alaska State Legislature prepared by the Division of Public Assistance indicates that that's what tribal TANF programs have been doing, getting people to work in Alaska's urban areas, hub communities, and even in some of the most economically challenged rural areas of the state. The report and the outcomes achieved through this pilot project indicate that the state and the tribes are headed in the right direction. SB 51 enables us to collectively and collaboratively stay what clearly appears to be a good course. In addition to steadily increasing the number of families moving off of welfare and onto work, TCC's program statistics also indicate that more Native families receiving temporary assistance, particularly those who live in rural communities of the interior, are actually working for the assistance that they do receive. Fiscal year 2004, 56% of our total assistance caseload were engaged in a minimum of 30 hours of work activities each week, and over 58, or 404 out of 688 families served, were engaged in paid employment for at least part of that time. More people are working, and more people are paying more of their own way. More people are working, in part because of the Native Family Assistance programs that have been developed over the past 5 years of the pilot project, because they're working. Alaska's rural communities, through the regional Native nonprofit corporations, have been designing programs that better fit the needs of their families. Many have also been developing local and regional infrastructures that now rival the state's capacity to provide a comparable, comprehensive level of local service delivery, especially in rural, remote areas. Much of our infrastructure incorporates the active engagement of multiple collective partnerships involving federal, state, local, and tribal governmental agencies and programs, nonprofit agencies, private contractors, small businesses, labor unions, faith-based institutions, local schools, and vocational training and post-secondary institutions. We've situated our TANF program at Tanana Chiefs in a newly reorganized division, which is called Client Services. In our Client Development or Client Services Department, it includes everything from our higher education to adult vocational training, employment, vocational rehabilitation, youth, elder, and other child protection services, as well as housing and other assistance programs like energy assistance.
Can you summarize, Don?
Sure. If there's any shortcoming of this bill, it would be that it includes no references to child support enforcement programs that may be administered by a tribe. The landmark federal welfare reform legislation that enabled tribes to design and administer their own temporary assistance program also enabled tribes to administer their own child support enforcement programming. The U.S. Department of Health and Social Services has already approved the plan for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribes to start up a tribally administered child support.
Doesn't sound like a summary. Do you have a written statement, Don?
Okay, will do. I'll wrap up just by saying that SB 51 is about common sense programming that fits, but it's a lot more. It's about a sense of community. It's about savings, and it's about staying the course on something that's worked over the course of the past 5 years, and a lot of people willing to make it work.
Thank you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing and the 10-hour chiefs are doing. If Don, if you have some written testimony, I'd be glad to distribute it to the committee. And if you have any thoughts on whether or not the issue I raised earlier about people who are unwilling to relocate, continuing to get assistance, I'd really enjoy your thoughts on that, and thank you. We'll go now here in Juneau. I have two people. Dean George, would you like to speak, sir? And Amanda? All right. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dean George, and I'm the program coordinator for the Tlingit and Haida TANF program located here in Juneau, Alaska, and we serve the geographic region from Yakutat on to down to Saxman, excluding Metlakatla. I believe I provided every member of the committee with a written report. At this point, yeah, yes. And I'd be more than happy to entertain questions or read into testimony this written report.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question that may or may not be about what you've written here, but in looking over this legislation, was the program that you are directing now, was that part of the pilot program?
Yes, it is.
This? Okay, and so this is the first piece of statute, though, that actually puts this into law. And I missed last week's meeting, so I want to be sure we shouldn't be amending something else. This is all new law. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I think that the committee members can read this, and it's very well presented, and thank you. The questions for Dean?
The only thing I'd would like to say, Mr. Chairman, is that Clinton Haida is certainly in support of this bill and do have the same concerns that was voiced by our sister organization, Clinton Haida, Don Churchill, there you go, with regard to the child support enforcement, because Clinton Haida is in the process of applying for the child support enforcement program.
Well, maybe we'll see that in a separate piece of legislation. Amanda?
Hi, I'm Amanda Blackwood. I'm the TANF accountant, finance system specialist. I've worked for TANF since it started its program in July of 2000, and I've since worked my way up since then. I just wanted to address some of your guys' concerns that you guys have brought up, one, fraud being addressed with our clientele, and I feel that we have addressed fraud pretty readily and cut down on the what we term as double dipping, when they would previously, when they would use funds from Central Council and click at Haida and then run to the state to get TANF assistance there, and but not report what they had gotten from the council. So I feel that we have in a lot of ways circumvented and trimmed down that access, and we do feel that we hold the clients more responsible to the monies that they are issuing, and that they use it responsibly and pay what they need to be paying, and hopefully empowering them and enabling rather than enabling them to take care of what needs to be taken care of.
Have you prosecuted any of them?
No, we have not. We find that is somewhat time consuming, but we have found that when we say, okay, you didn't tell us this, we're going to recoup it from any future benefits, that actually holds longer in their memory, because now that they have, we most of the time recoup up to 50% of what they would be eligible for, and that can hurt a lot. And that has actually been far more effective than dragging them through the courts or going and involving some time-consuming and some financially-consuming processes in that way. So, and I do feel that we have, that they no longer are less likely to not tell us something because we have long years.
Good for you. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Green?
Everyone at this table would rather hear that you have 100% stopped any double dipping of people going to two different offices. So the next time we talk, I'd like to hear that you say it's near 99% than 50%.
No.
What she said was 50% of the money they're getting today, they only get 50% of the money they are entitled to today until they pay it back, I think.
Well, I would like to hear that the number of participants in that. I think everyone would like to hear that the number of participants who are even attempting that would be nil.
It is very,
I would say,
very
Mr. Chairman, well, if I may answer, with the experience that I've seen already with what we've been able to do in at the Clinton Haida TANF program, is such that it's just what your question is, and to me, I am, you know, very certain that it is 100% of everyone that we know of that has even attempted to double dip that we've gone after and made sure that we recouped whatever they've been overpaid.
Thank you.
for you. Good for you. If you, either of you have an opinion on this, the issue I've raised about people unwilling to relocate where jobs are, I'd enjoy a chance to talk to you about that in it after meeting. Any questions? Any more testimony? What's the will of the committee? Senator Olton?
I waited to see if other hands would go up, Mr. Chair. I move SB 51 with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves. We'll now take up SB 75.
Hello, Chairman Dyson and members of the committee. I'm Richard Monsager. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health. And thank you for the opportunity to introduce SB 75. I think you have in front of you some slides that we've made to help me introduce the bill. And my goal is to take the next 10 minutes or so to introduce the bill, and then we'll be available for questions. What I hope to do is to briefly review public health, what it is, problems with current statutes that this bill aims to fix, and then elements of the proposed bill, and then be available for questions if there are any. The next slide is a quote from the Institute of Medicine. Public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. There are many partners in public health, and what this bill is really focused on is the governmental part of the public health system. And partners are individuals, our nonprofits, our families, private community groups, and this bill really focuses on the governmental part. I think it's helpful to think back 100 to 150 years to think about what is it that governmental public health has contributed to the life we live in America today. And public health comes in places other than the Division of Public Health. For example, from my perspective as a physician, sewage removal and treatment in cities probably made the first really significant improvement in public health as that in the late 1800s moved into city municipal organizations. Safe water, protection from vaccine-preventable diseases, more what I'm used to in the health side, clean indoor air in the last couple of three decades, and then if you think back a couple of decades ago, removal of lead from gasoline as environmental toxins were identified that cause cancers and other problems, the governmental policies that have removed environmental causes or other causes of cancer or other illnesses. And so public health is much more than this little narrow part that I administer on behalf of the state called the Division of Public Health. The next slide is something that people ask me about a lot, and it's that public health is not health care. I've been a physician most of my life. This is not the doctor family, doctor individual part of the health care system. This is really about focusing on populations, focusing on prevention by and large, and not on treatment, and government plays a role here. For example, PPDs are a part of school bus employment for people that want to drive school buses, for teachers. We have PPD laws for testing for TB in kids in schools. We have immunization rules for kids as they start school. Injury prevention projects. We've partnered in the Division of Public Health with the logging industry in Southeast Alaska to figure out how to prevent logging accidents happening when vehicles tip over on logging loads. First, the question is epidemiology, what causes them? Second is how to partner with the industry for what different kinds of changes can they make, what kind of training issues, are there vehicle issues? All of those are activities that go on in the background and don't get talked about very much. Last summer, I want to tell a couple of stories here. Last summer, cruise ship docked in Whittier. People were sick. Physician's assistant called and noticed that there was vomiting and diarrhea on people getting off the cruise ship. We initially thought it was a typical norovirus that had broken on the cruise ship, which seems to happen most every summer on one or two cruise ships. It turned out in this case it was oysters. And it was oysters from Alaska, from Kachemak Bay. And it was an organism, the etiology was an organism called Vibrio parahemolyticus, which has never been cultured north of 60 degrees north latitude any time in the world until last summer. And it's when you go to New Orleans and you throw oysters out of season is what typically causes people to get sick down south that we hadn't really thought about it and had never any place in the world been thought about as a problem in the northern waters. Well, it was warm last summer. Prince William Sound, one of the farms, reported that at 6 feet down, water was 61 degrees Fahrenheit. And this organism grows at temperatures above 60 degrees or so. So the outbreak investigation to find out what it was, then to embargo those farms until the water cooled off, and now with DEC is putting in place before this summer, there's going to have to be sampling in place to look at oysters as they go to market to make sure they're provided safely. So this public health work is involved in places you don't expect it to surface and you can't predict ahead of time from year to year. I sometimes think about public health as being fairly analogous to a fire department. You need to train all the time, you practice on small outbreaks so that if something really bad happens, you're prepared. If we do our job right, you never know about us in the background. And that's where we try and stay most of the time. The next slide talks about the Division of Public Health. This is just really a summary of what it is we do and what our current organization on the state side is. The bill that's introduced really underpins this work and this organization. Since 911, 3.5 years ago, public health emergencies have come more to the fore from a bioterrorism and from a natural disaster point of view. Preparedness is a part of public health work. A lot of things have improved over the last 4 years, and this law underpins preparedness work too. We have strong disease surveillance systems in place, as the oyster story demonstrates. We've worked a lot on improving emergency operations. How would we react? I think for all of us, since the tsunami hit Southeast Asia in December, it's been a check step for us. Okay, are we prepared? Could we deal with coastal communities in Alaska? What are our systems in place about how we would react? It's that kind of thing that is probably more likely than a bioterrorist event that we need to be prepared for. Lots of new laboratory testing capacities have come to the fore since 911, since anthrax days. Chemical toxin testing. We have lots more proven testing capabilities now in Anchorage than we did back then. We are now a laboratory that can test for smallpox, plague, tularemia, brucellosis, botulism, chemical toxins, things one hopes we never have, but we're prepared for. A quick story about preparedness and kind of how the system worked. Back in 1996, on a Saturday afternoon, a teenager here in Juneau got sick. A doctor here thought it might be measles. The sample, a blood sample, was gold streaked that evening up to, was gold streaked to Fairbanks on Friday afternoon to the laboratory. Saturday morning, the staff said it was measles, and down here in Juneau, by noontime on Saturday, they were working at figuring out what the status of that family was, how many other kids had been exposed, who needed vaccine. That's the kind of work that needs to go on in the background to prevent spread of disease. SARS, most of you in this table were present during the SARS amendment to our statutes in 2003. And at that time, it became apparent that if that disease showed up in Alaska, we did not have the ability to isolate or quarantine. Thankfully, the legislature was in session and amended the law to give us authority to do so for SARS if it had shown up. We are lots more prepared now, and in 2003, we were more prepared than we would have been in 2001 due to the preparedness work of working with hospitals. Very quickly, I was a doc at the Alaska Native Medical Center at that time. I remember getting what we call health alerts coming electronically across my computer almost daily there for a while about what to look for, how to recognize it, how as physicians we needed to react if patients showed up that met the criteria. And for any situation in the future, that preparation is now in place. But the reason the bill is before you is because of weaknesses. The next slide looks at weaknesses we have to enhance that. SB 75 is to address the underpinning statutory weaknesses. The next SB 73 is weaknesses with a virology laboratory in Fairbanks. We're very dependent on federal funds for a lot of our preparedness work, and that was okay for 2 or 3 years while the federal money and attention was on that subject. The dwindles started last summer, as federal government redirected monies that we had been depending on here in a rural state to cities. Cities had been arguing that they were more vulnerable than rural states. All of my colleagues in rural states across the country have said, yes, we understand the city's concern, but if you're in Nebraska, if somebody messes up a federal feedlot at a beef plant in Nebraska, all of us in the country are affected. That debate is ongoing. I think the dwindles are probably going to continue this based on what I hear from Washington. There's a slide there that has some pictures, old public health enemies, polio. You see kids there in braces from the 50s, TB there in the lower right-hand corner. TB is still here in Alaska. We deal with that. That's our kind of, I shouldn't say it this way probably, but it's our training disease. It's our every month experience as to do we have surveillance, do we know how to do outbreak investigations, do we know how to find people that have active disease. The bad news is for us here in Alaska is we've got a couple generations still to go. There's so much disease, there was so much disease, and we have it in elders as they get sicker and start coughing and reactivate their disease. We're going to live with this, and we have to always be prepared to deal with and minimize TB outbreaks. Traditional disease control really has used the tools of quarantine and isolation. Isolation being if somebody is sick with an infectious condition and you can't treat it, you isolate them from other people. Quarantine being people that may have been exposed, maybe get sick, and you quarantine them. This, we most recently know about this nationally with anthrax on the East Coast, is people that had been exposed, is how do you quarantine them, get treatment until they're no longer potentially infectious and then can be released. Nobody would have thought until that fall that anthrax would come back in this country. The next SARS, all of us in the public health world are worried about something called avian flu. It exists in Southeast Asia. It apparently has now become endemic in the bird populations in Southeast Asia. The mortality rate is pretty scary. For the last 2 years now, the mortality rate is 70%, and this attacks young adults and healthy people. Thankfully, it's not a disease that it seems very transmissible to humans yet. It's mostly from bird to human and people that are in very close poultry-raising occupation. The last 2 months, though, are somewhat scary to me as a doc in that the first World Health Organization has reported the first 3 cases of apparent human-to-human transmission. Everybody in the public health world is worried about this disease. If it mutates and becomes easily transmissible human-to-human, this is a very bad disease. We're going to need to be prepared if that disease were to start moving around the world, and given our air cargo connections to Asia, we're a state that needs to be prepared to be able to isolate or quarantine people if that were to happen in the next few years. When I talk to people from CDC, they say it's not a question of if, it's only a question of when, which is kind of a scary statement to think about. So in my view, establishing this law and improving and bringing it up to date is really the right and the ethical thing to do. Now I want to talk for just a few minutes about the bill itself. Our current laws are really based on 1949 statutes from territory days. They've been amended a couple of times, once in 95 for TB and once in 2003 for SARS. It really doesn't address issues that our cultures and our community of today expect, doesn't deal well with issues of chronic disease and the issues that really cause morbidity and mortality to us today. The proposed bill you have in front of you has a statutory framework supporting public health. It has clear authorities for conditions of public health importance, and our current statute has nothing about due process. So if a person is concerned that government is overreaching or government has made a mistake, it is very unclear what their appeal rights are. It's really up to an individual judge in a different part of the state to decide how they would deal with that. And in my view, this bill is all about trying to find the right balance between the mission of protecting public health and the individual's right to due process in the case that they think government has overreached, and to try and find that right balance point. The definition of essential public health services are based on the nationally accepted definitions from the U.S. Public Health Functions Task Force. The Institute of Medicine has published 2 reports in the last 15 years. It's really based on that work. It states the describes the state's role in protection and promotion of the public's health, provides clear authority for surveillance, for epidemiologic investigations, for medical treatment, quarantine, and isolation. Another example, we think about this in terms of infectious disease, but let me just give a couple stories from last summer and last fall here in Alaska that don't have to do with infectious disease. Some of you may remember there was controversy last summer about lead poisoning subsistence foods in the corridor coming out of the Red Dog Mine, and that the people in Kivalina and those other villages in that region were at risk from lead dust coming out of Red Dog Mine. We had worked, had done surveys of blood of people 10 years ago. We went back this fall now and asked anybody that wanted to, and we cooperated with CDC and we tested people again. And again, just like before, people have no evidence of any absorption of lead. It's the type of lead the Red Dog Mine mines. It's partly the industry has improved their practices. The trucks are covered. But answering public concerns up in that area. Another concern is in villages in the Ambler area. There's asbestos in the gravel. All of the construction was shut down in Ambler last summer because of asbestos in the gravel and questions about can this produce public health problems just like indoor asbestos. What's going on this winter now is working with the community and getting people to provide copies of their x-rays, supplying them to an expert in Wisconsin, and then in a few people that look like they have some scarring or their lungs, go back to those individuals to see what their occupational history was and to try and before next summer's construction season to work out with Department of Transportation and Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium plans for how the gravel in that river valley can be used for construction. So that's the kind of work that is non-infectious that also is important for public health that we do in the background. So SB 75, if you look at how it's outlined, there are five real parts to it: purpose and intent, administration, public health authority, the legal representation and court powers. You can see sections 9, 10, and 11 are listed there, and then general provisions. I don't intend to talk too much about that unless you have questions. I think the important thing, again, is to say is trying to find the right balance in the mission of public health and individuals' due process. If you look at the next slide, though, the first three parts, Part 1, Section 1, is the purpose and intent. Part 2, Sections 4, 5, and 7, to modernize the public health powers, which we talked about, to clarify the nature of regulation for reporting. We do collect a lot of data, mostly unidentified, but some with identifiable information. And we are, as custodians of people's data, really have a big responsibility, in my view, to keep that information confidential and secure. And there really is nothing in statute that really says how important that is. Now, we abide by federal HIPAA laws and so on, but this is to really state that if we're going to be custodians of data, we need to have responsibility back to protect it. And defines the definition of condition of public health importance, so where is it that we would have authority to do work and for what purposes, when do powers get exercised. And then the meat of the bill, I think most people would say, is in Section 8. It's the quarantine and isolation and medical treatment part. Just one story, as we've drafted the bill, we've wrestled with the question on treatment side. Let's assume somebody has an infectious condition for which there is treatment. Most people will voluntarily agree to get treated. Some people might say, no, I don't want to. In the model act that is out there for states to look at in the background that we use to test this would say that states should have the authority to mandate treatment. As we've thought about it, our thought is our job is to protect the public's health. The individual has a choice to make at that moment. They can choose to be isolated so as not to infect other people, or they can choose to get treated. And that's really an individual choice. And so we have not in this bill proposal said that the state would have the authority to mandate treatment against somebody's will. We can mandate screening, and then there's a lot of caveats in the bill about the limitations on that, and testing, but the person then decides, do they want to be treated? And finally, the last slide is where I hope by summertime we're not anymore. and that is there's only one state in the country that doesn't have adequate statutory authority to quarantine in response to a hypothetical bioterrorism attack scenario, and that's us, because we only have authorities for two diseases. So if smallpox showed up here in our state someplace today, we would have to try and persuade a judge that our general governmental authorities are broad enough for us to immediately isolate that person, and hours count with this disease. This is one where smallpox is a disease where one wants to be able to isolate them within hours, not days. With that, I think I will stop.
Well done. Appreciate what you and the department are doing. Any questions for Dr. Unsager?
Quick one, Mr. Chair, and Doctor, again, it was a very good presentation. I'm just curious, and it was piqued by looking at the sectional analysis, that Section 3 deletes a citation to a statute that would be repealed by the bill regarding TB screening of public school employees. And in your presentation, you noted that TB still is an issue in Alaska, so I'm curious as to the purpose behind that language in Section 3.
Senator Elton, through Chairman Dyson, in the background, we've been working on TB issues at the same time. And the cost benefit of all of our screening TB rules in most of the state doesn't justify annual testing of every school teacher in the state of Alaska right now. And so if, independent of this bill, we've been working in the background to, on a regulatory basis, change. But this is one that's in statute, and so we're taking an opportunity to put this one forward is to fix that rather than put in a whole separate statute bill. There are a whole series of changes in TB that were valid 15 years ago in most of our state. It isn't the biggest issue that it was. In some parts of the state, it still is. But the blanket testing of all school teachers every year doesn't seem justified in most of the state anyhow. We would, if this has changed, then we would be working with education to then, on a regulatory basis, in some parts of the state it probably still is necessary, like we test some kids in Western Alaska, but we don't test all kids in the whole state every year. In Juneau, we don't. We test twice during their school years instead of every year.
And just a quick follow-up. So that reduces the costs on districts. That would be a cost that the district would have. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
But you can still do whatever you need to do in a regulation. Just gets out of the compulsory annual.
It puts it into a regulatory place where we can do what's appropriate rather than mandating.
I think I get screened every time I renew my foster parent license. All right, thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we do have an outbreak of some unknown disease up here, what's the interaction between CDC and the Public Health Department?
Senator Olson, through Chairman Dyson, it's somewhat complicated arrangement that works well because we're a small state and we know people. For example, on cruise ships, when until the ship docks, CDC has authority. Until somebody's on land, they have authority, then we take over. This could be really complicated and really a mess if we didn't talk regularly. With back when SARS was a possibility, CDC has the authority to stop and inspect international air carriers. And in fact, the feds are getting ready to establish a quarantine office in Anchorage, probably this summer, that would have two or three staff people that would be dealing with that potential of quarantine authority such as that. Because the Arctic Investigations Program is in Anchorage, and because we're a small state, we're all on a first-name basis, and we work out the authority questions pretty readily. The cruise ship issues now have gotten worked out very well between the state CDC and the cruise ship lines. In fact, Dr. Funk, who's our acting chief of epidemiology, is on a first-name basis with the head of health practices for Princess Cruises. And it's that kind of a relationship that makes it work.
Good, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible to go ahead and have a cruise ship not dock and have it be essentially quarantined so it is not going to be exposing the people in the port to a potential epidemic that could be happening?
Senator Olson, yes, the answer is yes. CDC, if they decide they're involved with a ship, they decide whether people can get off the ship at all. And so people could be quarantined and isolated on that ship to make decisions about who can leave and who can't.
The last question I have, Mr. Chairman, as we look at this bill here and I guess in the interaction between CDC, would they have a problem with that because of Alaska's constitution and being more individually oriented as opposed to what's best for the population?
Senator Olson, through Chairman Dyson, I've shown a draft of this and to Dr. Butler, who's the head of the Arctic Investigations Program for CDC, and he doesn't see any issues between this bill and CDC's authorities.
Actually, I have one last question, Mr. Chairman. As you talked about the scenario between the Vibrio hemolyticus and the difficulty that was happening, or for that matter, I guess it was down here that the questionable test that needed to be done, and one of the bills has to do with the building of a new lab in up there in Fairbanks. Looking at the transportation system here in the state of Alaska, and that essentially all aircraft are headed toward Anchorage as opposed to going to Fairbanks, in order to cut down that time to have those samples evaluated by the lab, wouldn't you think it's somewhat more to the advantage of the healthcare delivery system that the lab be located in a central location as opposed to another peripheral site? And give us the reason why, I guess it's...
I think he should suggest Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Matsu, and then everything would be covered.
Senator Olson, through Chairman Dyson, this really does get at the core of the next bill for consideration. The debate and the thought about sample processing, I think, is really is an important one. Mm-hmm. If one thinks about from a oyster farming perspective in Southeast, the Environmental Health Laboratory that tests oysters and will be responsible for the regulations for that is in Anchorage. But for human samples for viruses, I think we have proven over the last 30 years that we can get samples to Fairbanks fast enough to make viral diagnoses. Now, if we didn't have many flights a day between Anchorage and Fairbanks, might that be a problem? Potentially. But we do, and I don't anticipate that's going to stop. I think it's as much an issue coming from Nome to Anchorage to Fairbanks as it is from Juneau to Anchorage. I think the issue is the same, is can we get samples to Fairbanks fast enough to make diagnoses? My judgment, the answer is yes.
The governor can fly him in his jet.
I guess going one step further, Mr. Chairman, if I could. If I'm out there in Dutch Harbor, and I've got a fox that's bitten somebody, and there's obviously the question of rabies, you've got only a certain period of time that you can harvest that brain, send it on in for evaluation, and the time to get to another site besides Anchorage, I would say, gets us into that critical period where you've got somebody out there ready to start foaming at the mouth. And having seen that kind of disease, it's not something you forget.
Senator Olson, through Chairman Dyson, I think the biggest risk from Dutch Harbor is getting to Anchorage, not getting to Fairbanks.
It's getting out.
If we can get it to Anchorage, we can get it to Fairbanks in a few more hours, and that's adequate. The biggest issue from rural Alaska is, can we get it to the hub facility in the first place? From where you work, villages in Nome, is the weather flying and preventing getting to Anchorage? If we can get to Anchorage, we can get it to Fairbanks.
Right, we're going to take up SB 75, the A version is what we have before us, and I believe that you have an amendment you would like us to consider,
yes.
Sir?
We've been provided an amendment. When the bill was introduced from the governor's office, there had not been discussion yet with the Office of Public Advocacy, and so Department of Law and Office of Public Advocacy have worked out the proposed amendment that satisfies the points of view of both Department of Law and Office of Public Advocacy. Assistant Attorney General Branch is here if you have questions about it.
Mr. Chairman, move amendment number 1, 24G-1.
Objection? Seeing none.
I mean, just as a... Do amendments have to have a name on them? As a point of...
I don't put my name on.
No.
I don't
know the answer to that.
Senator Wilkin. All right. Is objection to amendment number 1? Seeing none, number 1 is adopted. We also have another amendment. Is this... This is by Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I move amendment number 2, and I'm prepared to speak to it.
I'll object to the record.
All right. Senator Elton, and please stand by. Stay there, please, with Dr.
Mr. Chair, this was prepared kind of on your behalf and my behalf. We're both co-prime sponsors of a bill that provides that transportation of dead bodies not require a waiver process. And the genesis of the bill and the genesis of this amendment is that right now, if families of members of some faiths, especially the Jewish faith, which don't believe in embalming, want to have the bodies buried in the Holy Land or next to relatives in other states or in other jurisdictions, it requires embalming before they can be shipped out. Right now, under a waiver process that the doctor might want to talk to, that doesn't appear to be based in existing law, waivers have been issued in these circumstances. But it is an additional threshold for families who are often dealing with distressing family issues at the time need to go through. This provides that these bodies can be transferred unembalmed unless there's a public health risk. So I would just suggest that in one sense, this amendment is a workload reduction. It means that we don't have to take up the separate bill, and it means that Dr. Mansager doesn't have to come back. It fits into this bill on page 6, line 17, which deals with the transportation of dead bodies. Again, if members of the committee want to know more about the genesis of this, I feel free to I try to answer any questions that they might have.
Dr. Mansager?
I have no objection. I don't think we haven't had time to study it. I talked with Senator Elson at lunchtime. I know there's a separate bill. We have no objection to this going here or being handled in a separate bill or asking us to deal with it by regulation. I think it's your call as to how you want us to do it.
And as I understand it, sir, with bodies that are sealed, there's no public health issues by not embalming the body, or whatever they are can be taken care of and are in a routine manner.
Dry ice is available today in a way that wasn't when the statute was written several decades ago.
Mr. In a conversation I had with another member of the House, who was also interested in this, said they had run into kind of a roadblock and had to do with transporting across state lines, certain state lines, and certain types of transport. There were prohibitions, and that you could essentially end up unable to transport the body out of the state. Is there any method by which you can assure that that is not the case, or do you know if that's true or not? Or
Senator Green through Senator Dyson, I have only a preliminary answer. We've done some study. This amendment that's been offered says, or for compliance with federal law. My understanding is federal law covers the jurisdiction across state lines, and that this would be with that clause in there, we would be okay. But to say that we have done a real thorough study of every state statutes and how that interacts with federal statutes, we've not done that yet.
A note that this bill goes to state affairs and into judiciary before finance, so there'd be some more opportunities to deal with it. But if anything further, Senator Green?
Says it go to finance.
You're right.
And to that point, Senator Green, I mean, there is no fiscal note attached to SB 39 either, so that shouldn't implicate this bill.
You're right. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there ever been a time where a disease has been spread by a body that wasn't, to your knowledge, that wasn't embalmed?
Senator Olson, through Senator Chairman Dyson, I asked that question of the medical examiner, and he's not aware of any.
I'm talking about something more global than
otherwise.
Anything reported in the journals?
I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is the objection to the amendment maintained?
Yeah.
All right. With no objections, the amendment is adopted.
I would like to say, Ms. Chairman, though, if we find out more information that kind of negates all of this, I think we definitely need to
you betcha.
Get her on the side of caution. I have no problem with it at all.
Mr. Chair, my staff has been taking notes, and we will get back to you. Work with the doctor.
All right. I have in Anchorage, Nathan Johnson wishes to testify on SB 75. Can you hear us, sir?
Yes, I can.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Nathan Johnson. I am division manager for the Anchorage Municipal Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm here today on behalf of the municipality of Anchorage and the department in support of SB 75. I would like to express our appreciation to the state DHSS and the administration for bringing this bill forward. It's long overdue. As Dr. Monsager mentioned earlier, the state statutes now are antiquated and are derived largely from circumstances of nearly 50 years ago. So in this age of global travel and increasing number of drug infectious diseases, I think it's imperative that we update our public health laws, especially since we are now facing not only the threat of, or possible threat of bioterrorism, but as Dr. Monsager mentioned, with avian flu, we're just one plane ride away from anywhere on the planet, and time becomes of the essence when you've got an infectious disease outbreak. It's critical that we be able to act quickly and decisively, and this bill is important to the municipality because it brings the clarity and clear guidance ahead of time as to the extent and scope of our public health powers, and as Dr. Monsager said, provides very explicit due process to protect the individual rights. And it's very difficult in the moment that a disaster strikes or a situation escalates to want to go to the risk managers and attorneys and figure out to what extent we can act or cannot act. So we just basically wanted to step forward, offer our support for this bill. We've worked with the state of Alaska extensively, almost on a daily basis, with infectious disease surveillance and prevention and general public health work. This bill will serve to improve this relationship and will only further both of our abilities to serve the public's health. And with that, I'll take any questions. And thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions, Mr. Johnson? There are none. Thank you, sir. And in here we have Rod Bennett. Greetings, Rod.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Rod Beattie, President of Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I just want to also express our membership support for this bill. My 20 years of experience in public health and as state director in Utah, I could share with you a number of times where we were pleased to have had this kind of infrastructure in place when we entered into a pretty serious public health situation. But I sense a lot of support here on the committee, so I won't belabor the issue and go through all that. But I think the comments have been made that having this in place before something like that happens and spelling out clearly what their authority is and isn't and how those personal privacy protections versus the public health risk are weighed. And at one point in the bill, it says if the public health risk is so severe that the privacy issues have to be put aside while you deal with that threat, That's very important to, I think, have in place and make sure that the right people are there to make those decisions. And I think the bill's constructed quite well.
Any questions for Rod? Thank you, and thank you for the last couple of conversations we've had. Very enlightening. I just have one more question for you, Dr. Munsager. The Section 12 repeals a whole bunch of old law, and the only one that jumped out at us was had to do with the religious treatment of tuberculosis. What in the world is that all about?
Chairman Dyson, would it be okay if I ask Dan Branch?
Sure.
Sorry.
What page?
24. Last virtually words of the bill.
Hey, Mr. Chair, this is Dan Branch, Department of Law. Excuse me. You kind of caught me unawares. I have a list of all the sections that are repealed. And it's my understanding that this bill will essentially upgrade what we have in place right now. That whole chapter deals with tuberculosis. We have one provision that deals with SARS. And it wasn't the intent to remove any protections from those who have religious beliefs that might be implicated by quarantine isolation testing. In fact, the bill has protections built in for that reason. I laughed a little bit because you caught me unawares on a particular question. If you want to, I'd be happy to look at that provision and call your aide.
Okay. And I don't think we'll hold up the bill waiting for that, but I would enjoy knowing what in the world that was about whenever it was done. And thank you. Any further questions from the committee? So where are the committee?
SB 75
on committee
with recommendations
and individual.
I don't know who this one.
As amended.
Yes, thank you. As amended.
Is there objection? Seeing none, SB 75 is moved. Good. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You might as well stay there and we'll take up your lab that Senator Green wants to move to Mat-Su.
And she left too. Thank you so much. SB 73, this is Richard Munsager again, is a bill for the construction of a state public health virology laboratory in Fairbanks. Again, I have several pages of handouts to just try and talk through context and what the bill is. For those of you who haven't ever seen this laboratory up in Fairbanks, there's a picture there on the second slide that shows a person working in a small laboratory. As noted in the title, it's the place where our state diagnoses viruses as causes of disease. There's a listing, by no means a complete listing, of the types of viruses they deal with up there on a daily basis. And I'd like to tell again another story.
Just a second, Richard. I'm not sure that we have the slides.
Oh, I have the ones we used for the last book.
We have some more out here. They just won't be in color. We'll hold on a second. Probably back in your office. The cover sheet looked a lot the same.
I knew it was my fault. I just didn't know why.
Well, it's our fault for making them look so much alike.
All right.
Thank you for stopping me.
That's all right. Go ahead, please, sir.
So the second page shows a picture of a guy working in the laboratory up in Fairbanks. I just want to tell a story again, and it's from last spring's Iditarod. You may remember that as they were getting ready for the Iditarod to start last spring, people in McGrath, the folks who were out there for trail maintenance and veterinarians, started getting sick. By being able to get samples quickly from McGrath to Anchorage to Fairbanks, Senator Olson, norovirus was diagnosed the next day, and they knew that then in time to both get gloves and supplies out to the workers along the trail and at the mushers banquet before they started to talk about how mushers should take care of themselves and their dogs to prevent themselves from getting sick. The outbreak was stopped before midpoint in the race, and when they got to Nome, There are pictures from Nome showing the people were serving food in with gloves on, but nobody was sick after the point of the race. We could never have done that in previous years before being able to diagnose that viral cause and to know how to prevent transmission quickly. And it also, to me, is a story of why we need to have capacity in-state to be able to make diagnosis. In the old days, as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, that sample would have been sent to Atlanta. We would have known what it was 3 weeks later. And, of course, the race would have been done. Last week, CDC put out an advisory about influenza. We use our laboratory in Fairbanks as one of the sentinel laboratories in the country for diagnosis of influenza every year. The recommendation from CDC is that this virus should only be cultured in what's called a basic science safety laboratory 3 lab. Well, we don't have that capacity in Fairbanks, so the staff use what they call BSL-3 techniques and methods, and we hope we don't ever have a break in procedure. So far, in the last 7 or 8 or 9 years, none of the staff have gotten influenza A, so we're using that as an indicator that our staff competencies and trainings are pretty good. But it's not a good practice as we think about the bad viruses that exist in this world to be exposing staff and the ventilation system in that old building up there, potentially be exposing other people to those kind of viruses. We should be containing them and managing diagnosis of those viruses in a place that can protect people. The current lab is in an old building there on the UAF campus. You can see on the next slide, it's been there for quite a while. It's in a small space. Last summer, we had a review team from the Association of Public Health Laboratories come up and look at our laboratory system and to look at some of the questions that were asked a few minutes ago about Fairbanks and Anchorage and what problems, what should we do about the laboratory in Fairbanks. The problems you can see listed there: severe space, inadequate lighting and ventilation, fails to meet today's laboratory building and ADA accessibility, potential for future eviction if the university decides that that building either needs to come down or needs to be changed for future use in the future, and in quotes, it's an accident waiting to happen. Now, their review team came forward and said we really should build in Fairbanks. Why? One is our state should have redundancy in laboratory capacity in different cities, given we live in a state with earthquake potential. If we lose one of our laboratories in one of the cities, we could move the most important functions in an emergency basis to the other city. Two is the human staff capabilities of the staff that are in Fairbanks are superb. The lab in Fairbanks, despite its physical plant problems, is viewed as one of the best in the country. Their diagnostic skills are superb. And if we move to Anchorage, and most of them don't move, we're going to be faced, given our recruitment difficulties in Alaska, I would guess it would take us 2 years at a minimum to rebuild the human capability if it wasn't there. And finally, the university is building a human biology and genetics mission in recent years now. Having a BSL-3 lab in Fairbanks on the campus offers a great deal of opportunity for the researchers to do things they couldn't do otherwise. And so since last summer, as I've been meeting with UAF staff, to say that the biologists are excited about the possibility of that being up in Fairbanks is to put it mildly. Finally, this gives us more capacity in state for what we call in the business surge capacity. If we really have a big outbreak, could we handle samples in an adequate number? Our current lab clearly couldn't. The final slide shows the cost and the proposed location. It would be adjacent to the new building that on the UAF campus that's under construction would be connected. The price is $24.2 million, financed through certificates of participation. And the last slide, I think you have a drawing that shows you how it would be connected to the building that's under construction right now. This is a view looking north. If you've been in Fairbanks recently, the hole in the ground before they fit for the winter, this would be on the north side of that building on the ridge.
Thank you.
With that, I'll take questions.
Questions for Dr. Munsinger. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So orient me there, Doc. Which way is, let's say, the Geophysical Institute from there?
Geophysical Institute is to the west.
So on this, it would be, this is north, so it would be here?
North is up to the yellow going that direction.
North is here?
Yes.
Okay, and Geophysical is up here? Is this the statewide building here?
Arnold?
The museum would be right next to you.
The museum's right there.
Right, this is north, museum's here? Here?
I'm sorry.
This is Arnold Diebold, all the facilities manager. Is it okay if I let, I've got my directions mixed up right now. Arnold?
Is this north, Arnold? Am I north here?
That's looking south.
South?
Is this north?
You don't listen to me.
That's all right.
Sorry, I don't
have a copy. Is this north?
That is looking north. No, I'm sorry. I had it the other way. Where the way you're pointing up is where the museum renovation project is taking place right now. Immediately adjacent to that.
Oh, this is north? Museum? Is that right?
I apologize here. Biology lab is on the north. The bird is to the south.
That's what I thought. The road comes around like this and makes an L.
Let the record reflect, Dr. Munsinger was actually right to start with.
From the Geophysical Institute, you take the road and then it turn around the corner. And it's sitting there.
So it's up in the complex, the West Ridge complex.
Yes, absolutely.
Around the museum and the Geophysical Institute. Okay, thanks. Who owns this building?
The building would be owned by the department located on university land. And the university and the department will have a land lease at no cost to the department. And we're talking about a 30-year lease with 10-year options.
And the COPs are for 30 years at $2.375 million per year?
COP, Senator Wilkin through Chairman Dyson, COPs are for 15 years at $2.3 million per year.
Thank you.
All right. So we have before us is a working document, the / A version, and I believe you have an amendment that Senator Wilkin, I bet, would be glad to offer.
Chairman, move Amendment 1.
I'll object so that you can explain it, would you please, sir?
The amendment that's been offered is the result of discussions between the university and us. After the bill was introduced, the university pointed out that the land is owned by the university. We will be leasing it, so the university will be providing the land rather than the legislature or the bill mandating placement of a department building on what would be university property. It satisfies university interests, and it satisfies their concerns about their federal land grant status as a university in terms of the amendment language.
I will remove my objection to the amendment. Is there any other objections? Seeing none, Amendment 1 passes. Any further questions or discussions on this? I have two people who have signed up to testify. One more, Tom Boutine. Tom?
Mr. Chairman, thanks. Tom Boutine, Department of Revenue. I'll just take a minute in case anybody wants to talk about credit issues, the financing, or our fiscal note. We have talked to the credit rating agencies about this prospective debt, and it doesn't present a credit concern. And with that, if anybody wants to talk about the fiscal note or the financing or debt structure or anything, I'd be sure glad to answer questions.
And this will appear in finance. Senator Wilkin,
if I might jump ahead to finance. So, Tom, if the money was available and we pay cash for this on page 2, line 20, 18 through 20, we would save $11,572,000. Is that correct?
That is correct, over 15 years. And that's an estimate, of course, of debt service. on Tuesday, January 25th, we did, that is, the State Bond Committee and Department of Revenue did a competitive sale of debt, which will be rated, which was rated exactly the same as this was. However, it just had a 10-year final maturity. It was a refinancing of four existing lease debt issues, and is a very popular, I'll say, sale. We had 10 bidders, and the winning bid was 3.102%. But to do fiscal notes, we try to be conservative, but this would be a competitive sale, and if the debt were being sold today, it's a pretty flat yield curve, would be substantially under the 4.9% in the fiscal note, but who knows where interest rates are going to be.
Thank you. Good question. Any further questions? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who's all involved, or what entities are involved with the COPs? Certificates of participation?
Well, we use the State Bond Committee, which is the Commissioner of Commerce is the chair under Title 37. Commissioner of Revenue is the secretary, and Commissioner of Administration is the third member of the State Bond Committee. The staff work is done by Department of Revenue. The state has and has had for decades both a financial advisor under contract and a bond counsel. And so the debt is structured right there in Department of Revenue, and for the past several years, the Department of Revenue has sold debt like this by competitive sale over the internet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further questions or discussions? Anybody else wants to testify on this bill? I see that John Blake and my good friend Karen Perdue are available online to answer questions. Anybody have questions for John or Karen? Anyone else wants to testify?
Hi, this is John Blake. I'm here from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Yes, sir.
I'm director of the Office of Research Integrity, interim director of sponsor programs. I'm also the attending veterinarian up here, and as such has been the user or chairman of the user committee. So I just wanted to, thank you, Senators, for the opportunity to spend a second to express our strong interest in having the State Virology Lab stay here. The State Lab folks have been participating with us right from square one from about 5 years ago with the planning and programming of our new facilities. And the building that Dr. Munsinger was pointing out that would be attached to the new State Virology Lab, we actually designed that building with the intent or the hope that the State Virology Lab would be attached at the north end of that building. So as I said, I just wanted to make it quite clear that we're extremely supportive and looking forward to their staying put here where we think they belong.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for John? Senator Olson?
Dr. Blake, could you tell me what it's going to be like in 5, 10, 15 years from now when the current personnel have retired and you're going to be recruiting new professional staff to that area? How hard it's going to be, or how you anticipate overcoming the idea that Fairbanks has got 40 below and they come up from the lower 48 where they're dealing with 70 degree weather.
With all due respect, what's exciting right now is the university's new initiatives with the National Institutes of Health, and our primary focus to move into biomedical research. We've got some good funding from them right now. We are searching right at this moment for new microbiologists with a focus on infectious disease research. And I think although we've had excellent cooperation and collaborative work with the State Virology Lab for many, many years, we're actually expecting that to substantially increase. And we feel that the integration between the diagnostic effort from the State Lab and the research effort from the university will be a really, really good bonus for the state.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, Dr. Blake, you're in favor of global warming? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's a good funding source.
Any further discussion or questions in committee?
What's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, move to report Senate Bill 73 from Committee of Individual Recommendations and attached fiscal note.
As amended.
As amended, thank you.
Are there objections? Seeing and hearing none, the bill is moved. When's our next scheduled meeting? Monday?
Monday.
And what do we have up then? Remember?
Two bills regarding Office of Children's Services.
Okay, we have two bills coming up on OCS, former DFYS. We are adjourned. Thank you. Good work.
Jeez, I kind of like Noam calling the kettle black.